Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the Babylonian Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and we are taking a look at a heavy hitter and kind of an also-ran. Let's start with the heavy hitter. This is Gilgamesh, the eponymous protagonist of the Epic of Gilgamesh. Actually, that's not fair, because it's not called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Like, its Babylonian title isn't the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's He Who Saw the Deep. We just call it the Epic of Gilgamesh, as if to say it's, the one with Gilgamesh in it. Gilgamesh is the legendary hero. And now, last time I said that I am not usually a fan of including legendary hero characters in your D&D mythology, but Gilgamesh is kind of an exception, because if you know one thing about Babylonian mythology, you know about Gilgamesh. Again, we see the question of the boundary between Babylonian and other Bronze Age Mesopotamian mythology. Because even in the Babylonian versions of the story, Gilgamesh himself is not Babylonian, he's Sumerian. The educated classes of Babylonian society read, particularly in the early part of the period, not so much in the Neo-Babylonian period later on, but certainly in like the 1800s BCE, educated Babylonians could read Sumerian. Indeed, we have an example of a line written by a scribe in training, a student who said that he'd been beaten for speaking Akkadian in school. The idea, I guess, was that in order to learn Sumerian, you had to immerse. So this is a Sumerian story, which we know primarily in its Babylonian version. I say version, there are multiple versions. So at the time of the kind of first flourishing of a Babylonian empire around about 1800 BC, the story of Gilgamesh is potentially 1,000 years old. That's the date that is ascribed to, like, the historical Gilgamesh, who presumably doesn't have very much connection to the Gilgamesh of the epic. But there had already been Gilgamesh poems in Sumerian for centuries at this point. So the kind of standard Babylonian version, the one that, you know, if you pick up a book that's called the Epic of Gilgamesh, the one that you'll read, is from round about, I don't know, you know, like 1200 to 1000 BCE. I'm just looking at the chart in my edition of the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the translation by Andrew George. But the historical Gilgamesh, you know, probably lived sometime around 2800 BCE, and the oldest copy of a Sumerian Gilgamesh poem is from somewhere between 2100 and 2000 BCE. So the story of Gilgamesh had already been around for several hundred years, at the absolute minimum, by the time the first Gilgamesh poems were written. And it looks like what happened was that the Epic of Gilgamesh, that He Who Saw the Deep, is a larger poem that strings together a number of episodes that were already known about Gilgamesh, right? So there were existing poems about Gilgamesh and Enkidu fighting Huwawa. There were existing stories about Gilgamesh fighting the Bull of Heaven. And there appears to have been a connection between the idea of Gilgamesh and a lament, because there's an extended in the He Who Saw the Deep, when Enkidu dies, Gilgamesh delivers a lament for him, but there's an older version, which is a lament for Gilgamesh. I don't know if they're textually connected, but so the idea that Gilgamesh, you know, Gilgamesh examines themes of life and death, and specifically the idea that even this very powerful person, Gilgamesh, is mortal. So the idea of like a grief section seems important. There's also other separate stories about Gilgamesh and Enkidu that are not part of the main Epic of Gilgamesh. So it's not He Who Saw the Deep. So it's not the case that there is a single text called the Epic of Gilgamesh, but more like Gilgamesh is a figure like Robin Hood or King Arthur, where there are many stories about him which have a lot of shared elements between them, and it seems like someone took a bunch of them and tried to create like a standardized version. And they were apparently regarded as classical texts, because it seems like one of the reasons that we have multiple copies of some of these is that they were used as writing exercises in those scribal schools. This is my purely layman's perspective, by the way, so if I've got something wrong in there, I do apologize. So Gilgamesh is the king of the Sumerian city of Uruk, and sometimes he's portrayed as this very, like, wise and humane person, and sometimes not so much. He has a little bit of an arc. I said that before that the title of this text was He Who Saw the Deep. That's not even right. It's just the first line of the poem. Like a lot of ancient texts, it's simply known by its first line. He who saw the deep, the country's foundation, who knew, bit missing, was wise in all matters. So I'm going to read you a little bit of the beginning of He Who Saw the Deep. This is the translation by Andrew George. We're starting right around line 9, and we're going to introduce the city of Uruk, and then skip a bit, and then get into the description of Gilgamesh. Now, this is a fragmentary text. There are parts that are missing, there are parts that have been kind of like conjecturally, like they think they're pretty sure what it should say, and there are parts where we genuinely don't know what it should say. So I'm going to just try and gloss over those as best I can. He came a far road, was weary, found peace, and set all his labors on a tablet of stone. He built the rampart of Uruk the sheepfold, of holy Eanna the sacred storehouse. See its wall like a strand of wool, view its parapet that none could copy. Take the stairway of a bygone era, draw near to Eanna, seat of Ishtar the goddess, that no later king could ever copy. Climb Uruk's wall and walk back and forth, survey its foundations, examine the brickwork. Were its bricks not fired in an oven? Did the seven sages not lay its foundations? A square mile is city, a square mile date grove, a square mile is clay pit, half a square mile the temple of Ishtar, 3 square miles and a half, is Uruk's expanse. See the tablet box of cedar. Release its clasp of bronze. Lift the lid of its secret. Pick up the tablet of lapis lazuli and read out the travails of Gilgamesh, all that he went through. Surpassing all other kings, heroic in stature, brave scion of Uruk, wild bull on the rampage. Going at the fore, he was the vanguard. Going at the rear, one his comrades could trust. A mighty bank, protecting his warriors. A violent flood wave, smashing a stone wall. Wild bull of Lugalbanda, Gilgamesh, perfect in strength. Suckling of the august wild cow, the goddess Ninsun. Gilgamesh the tall, magnificent and terrible, who opened passes in the mountains, who dug wells on the slopes of the uplands, and crossed the ocean, the wide sea to the sunrise, who scoured the world ever searching for life, and reached, through sheer force, Utnapishti the distant, who restored the cult centers destroyed by the deluge, and set in place for the people the rites of the cosmos. Who is there can rival his kingly standing, and say, like Gilgamesh, it is I am the king? Gilgamesh was his name from the day he was born, 2/3 of him god and 1/3 human. It was the lady of the gods drew the form of his figure, while his build was perfected by divine Nudimud. A triple cubit was his foot, half a rod his leg, 6 cubits were his stride, and so on and so on and so forth. So that sounds like a pretty positive portrayal of Gilgamesh, but actually, the initial characterization of him is a little bit unpleasant. He's something of a tyrant. In Uruk the sheepfold, he walks back and forth like a wild bull lording it, head held aloft. He has no equal when his weapons are brandished. His companions are kept on their feet by his contests. The young men of Uruk he harries without warrant. Gilgamesh lets no son go free to his father. By day and by night his tyranny grows harsher. Gilgamesh, the guide of the teeming people. It is he who is shepherd of Uruk the sheepfold, but Gilgamesh lets no daughter go free to her mother. The women voiced their troubles to the goddesses. They brought their complaint before them. And so they complained to the gods. The gods of heaven, the lords of initiative, to the god Anu they spoke. A savage wild bull you have bred in Uruk the sheepfold. He has no equal when his weapons are brandished, and so on and so on and so on. And so, as a result, Anu summons Aruru and tells her to create someone who could rival Gilgamesh. Let them summon Aruru, the Great One. She it was created them, mankind so numerous. Let her create the equal of Gilgamesh, one mighty in strength, and let him vie with him, so Uruk may be rested. They summoned Aruru, the Great One. You, Aruru, created mankind. Now fashion what Anu has thought of. Let him be a match for the storm of his heart. Let them vie with each other, so Uruk may be rested. The goddess Aruru heard these words. What Anu had thought of, she fashioned within her. The goddess Aruru, she washed her hands, took a pinch of clay, threw it down in the wild. In the wild, she created Enkidu the hero, offspring of silence, knit strong by Ninurta. So Enkidu is a wild man. He fights with Gilgamesh. They become friends. They go on some adventures together. And eventually, Enkidu dies. And this is the turning point for Gilgamesh. He realizes that he is mortal, and he doesn't like it.
He goes a bit mad and goes wandering, distracted by the loss of Enkidu.
For his friend Enkidu, Gilgamesh did bitterly weep as he wandered the wild. I shall die, and shall I not then be as Enkidu? Sorrow has entered my heart. I am afraid of death, so I wander the wild to find Utanapishti, son of Ubartutu.
Utanapishti is the only person who knows the secret of immortality. He was born before the flood, before Enlil tried to wipe out humanity with a flood. So Gilgamesh goes on this quest, you know, he encounters some gods, he encounters some monsters, and so on and so forth. And finally he gets to Utanapishti, who kind of tells him that this isn't really going anywhere. And he explains,
Enkidu indeed they took to his doom. But you toiled away, and what did you achieve? You exhaust yourself with ceaseless toil. You fill your sinews with sorrow, bringing forward the end of your days. Man is snapped off like a reed in a canebrake. The comely young man, the pretty young woman, all too soon in their prime, death abducts them. No one at all sees death. No one at all sees the face of death. No one at all hears the voice of death. Death so savage who hacks men down. Ever do we build our households, ever do we make our nests, ever do brothers divide their inheritance, ever do feuds arise in the land. Ever the river has risen and brought us the flood, the mayfly floating on the water. On the face of the sun its countenance gazes, then all of a sudden nothing is there. The abducted and the dead, how alike is their lot? But never was drawn the likeness of death, never in the land the dead greet a man. The Anunnaki, the great gods, held an assembly. Mamutum, maker of destiny, fixed fates with them. Both death and life they have established, but the day of death they do not disclose.
So Gilgamesh's quest for immortality is denied. He goes back to Uruk, and there this tablet ends. Now, there are many different, you know, other fragmentary tablets, and really, this Andrew George, this is like the Penguin Classics Epic of Gilgamesh. It's really good. It's really worth getting a hold of if you're interested in this kind of mythology. And in fact, in a minute where I'm going to talk about a sort of minor character who turns up in here because he's really good. So great. So how do we incorporate Gilgamesh into a game? I think there are two methods, right? The first is to put the PCs in the role of Gilgamesh. But I actually don't know about this one because, it kind of belies the zero to hero narrative, right? Gilgamesh is a hero to zero. He doesn't get more powerful as he goes on. He grows up. He confronts his own mortality. That might be kind of a heavy topic for a fantasy adventure game. I do like the idea that the PCs could be in the role of Enkidu. So there could be some hero who, because he's so powerful, is basically, he's sort of oppressing the locals without really knowing it. You know, it seems like Gilgamesh sort of doesn't necessarily mean to prevent the young men from going home to their fathers. He just kind of wants to fight and do sports and stuff all the time. He's a bit like a stalwart, if you remember those guys. He's just really hard charging. Gilgamesh doesn't want to prevent the young women from going to their mothers. He just doesn't understand that people are intimidated by him because no one is his match. So you could definitely have someone like that who sort of has to be finessed. Like, you have to fight him, but after that, he'll probably befriend you. And then you can go fight monsters and things together. You could even do that as the origin of a party, I suppose. But also, I think Gilgamesh is troubled by his own mortality. He actually makes an excellent kind of semi-divine figure. He'd be good on another plane. In the prime material plane, it's a bit weird that he hasn't figured out that he's mortal. He must have noticed that at least one of his parents was mortal. Assuming that this, you know, supposedly wise character, we're not trying to just portray as a big dope. We have to approach it from another angle. But if he's kind of semi-divine, or especially if he is a divine figure who has come to the prime material plane and just doesn't understand that he's been incarnated as a mortal, he definitely might, especially if he's kind of taken to brooding or gone into some kind of fit, he might be incapable of undertaking the quest for immortality. So the PCs might be the ones who have to go off and sail across the sea and encounter the stone ones and talk to what's-his-face, the boatman, and then talk to Utnapishti the distant, and so on and so forth. And then ultimately have to return to Gilgamesh with the disappointing news that there is no immortality. You should just be happy to be alive while he's alive. It reminds me a little bit of the Sumerian myth of Inanna's descent into the underworld, which I want to say we covered all the way back in season one, where Enki creates these two creatures, Kalaturu and Kurgaru, and sends them down into the underworld on a mission from him. Now, this is tricky because I don't tend to like quests where it seems like the PCs are carrying the main character's luggage. But I do think that the citizens of Uruk could definitely come and say,
you know, your old comrade, Gilgamesh, Lord of the Kulab, is, you know, he's been driven mad by the death of his friend, and, you know, he needs something to make it better. He keeps talking about Utnapishti. Do you know that guy? I think you could get away with something like that. The other character that I wanted to mention, who makes a bit of a cameo in the story of Gilgamesh, who he's referred to several times, is Namtar. Now, I may have mentioned Namtar back in the Sumerian season. I'm not sure. Namtar is the prime minister of the underworld. And he's sort of a god of disease, god of death. He's not the god of death, just more like a god of death. He does not rule the underworld, but he seems to, like, go and collect people. He is represented as, like, an implacable force of death. The old translation that I had in the collection of Poems of Heaven and Hell from Ancient Mesopotamia, at least I think that's what it was. I definitely have Poems of Heaven and Hell from Ancient Mesopotamia. I might have also had an Epic of Gilgamesh that I replaced with this one. But that translation read, "Inhuman Namtar is heavy upon him. Namtar, who drinks no water and eats no meat. Namtar, who has neither hand nor foot." The not having hands or feet thing is kept in here, but the translation there says, you know, he's going to die. He cannot eat or drink. So maybe, you know, maybe they're disagreeing about who's the person who doesn't eat or drink. But I'm willing to forgive Andrew George for taking away my great image of Namtar there, because there's a line in here that says, "Namtar, who has no hands or feet, Namtar, who knows not how to spare a man." That's raw. I like that. You know, if the panicking superstitious villagers tell you that Namtar is coming, who knows not how to spare a man. That's pretty good. I'm fond of Namtar. I played a character called Namtar, in fact, at one point. He was the evil alternate version of my character from another dimension. The main guy was called Ninshubar, who is the goody, the sort of the first minister of heaven, Inanna's sidekick. And so I thought it would be fun if the alternative version of Ninshubar were called Namtar. And before you ask, yes, I know that in Sumerian, Ninshubar is a woman. But Ninshubar, the Babylonian version of him, is male, I think. Again, not an expert. Even if you don't have Gilgamesh per se, I do like the idea of going to find some great hero who once did a great deed. Oh, you need the plant that, like, brings dead people back to life? Well, only one person knows where to find that, and that is Gilgamesh, Lord of the Kulab, right? Like, that you actually, what if you meet them at the end of their story where they've come to terms with mortality and the fact that there is no need for these heroics, but you are not so willing to let your party members linger in the underworld, and so you need to go find Utnapishti and learn the secret of immortality, and that means that you're going to have to go get the secret out of Gilgamesh, even though he's, like, well-adjusted now and doesn't want to share it with you, because instead, what you should do is mourn your friend and learn to be happy in your own mortality. I think there's something there. I think there's something with, you know, the person who was once a player character type and is now kind of past it, but who still has these adventures. I think maybe the reason that it works is that Gilgamesh's adventure is incomplete. We know that he dies, but he dies because he's mortal and all men die. It's not like Hercules, where his death is specifically part of his mythology. We can imagine an older Gilgamesh, a once great hero, now just living out his days as King of Uruk, trying to rule responsibly. And I think you can do something similar with, a Gilgamesh-inspired hero in your Babylonian mythology-inspired game. All right, having said that, let's talk about Giru. Giru is more commonly called Gira in translations that I've seen, and he is the fire god. As the fire god, he's also the god of smiths and the god of brick makers, which is actually a pretty important role when you consider the material for building things in Sumerian and Babylonian society would have been mud brick. He is the fire god. He's closely connected to the sun god, Shamash, who I think we talked about back in the Sumerian season. Like many gods, he's the son of Anu. He gets conflated with another fire god called Nuska, and sometimes they're the same character and sometimes they're not, and sometimes they're worshipped together and sometimes they're not. The version of the god presented in Deities and Demigods is a much more conventionally heroic character, and I think, again, this is an example of Ward maybe not having, like, an enormous amount to work with and just having been told this is the fire god. So he's given him a personality that is, you know, fiery. And that's fine. One of the things that I like about Gira in Babylonian mythology, as far as we know anything about him, he's not a super important, like, he's one of those gods that is important
in terms of the society, but we don't have a lot of like specific myths written about in the way that we do about Anu or Ea. But Gira has kind of a dual nature, because fire is both harmful and beneficial. So on the one hand, he's beneficial. He's the patron of smiths. He's the patron of brickmakers. He's the patron of all these trades without whom society could not function. But at the same time, I mean, he's the god of fire. He has this destructive potential. And so as a result, he has sort of two faces. He's both beneficial and threatening. And, you know, you don't want to wind up with the wrong face turned towards you, which I think makes for a fun fire cleric. If you're a cleric of some kind of fire domain, I do like the idea that you have, like, the hearth fire and the wildfire. You know, you're out there giving warmth to cold people and cooking people's dinners and helping people, you know, do their work and see in the dark. And then also, sometimes, people get you mad and it's burn, baby, burn. I think there's something there. I think a cleric of Gira could be a fun character, yeah. I suppose you could also view Gilgamesh as an inspirational character in that sense. Like, he's definitely a model for someone who takes their, like, fighting impulses and subordinates them to a kind of greater civic good. So I guess in that sense, he's particularly if you follow that kind of older D&D idea of a fighter, that the sort of, like, the ultimate goal of a fighter is not to be an unstoppable, personal, like, one-man army character, but to achieve political and military power. So that the high-ranking fighters are, I mean, they're good at fighting, but ultimately what they are is generals. I think you could see that with Gilgamesh. I like the description of his martial virtues, right? You know, the defending the rear of the column, the, you know, one that his comrades could rely on. That's pretty good, too. That's a very fightery sort of idea. Again, particularly in that kind of early versions of D&D, where spellcasters were very vulnerable, and not only could they die if they got hit, but they could lose the effectiveness of their spells, and therefore they needed to be protected by ranks of fighting men. The idea of fighters as fundamentally protective rather than fundamentally about, you know, putting fire on target, I think is very present in modern editions of the game, but kind of sometimes doesn't get played because ultimately it's maybe not that exciting. It needs to be socially rewarded if it's going to have any value, because it's not viscerally fun in the same way that, you know, booting some hobgoblins is. All right, well, that is about all the Babylonian mythology we have time for today. In our next episode, we have got two heavy hitters. I'm talking about Ishtar, the goddess of love and war, and also Marduk. Listed here as the god of the city, wind, thunderstorms, and rain, but perhaps more importantly, the patron deity, if not the supreme deity, of the Babylonians. So we're going to have a lot to talk about with these two. After that, we've got two more. We've got Nergal, the god of death, and Ramman, the god of storms and thunder. Then the episode after that, we're going to do a wrap-up in which I think I'm going to talk about a lot of characters who are not in here. And then we're going to move on to another topic. That was pretty brief, but I think there was actually a lot of interesting stuff in it, and there's still plenty more to come as we talk about Ishtar and Marduk. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.